Hey guys, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for over 10 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures, how through them God has made himself known to us, and his ultimate desire to dwell among us.
We want to invite you to join us on this journey as God reveals himself to us through his word.
We also want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Merry Christmas Eve, right?
Yeah, I don't
count back seven eves.
I don't go
Merry
for that.
I don't go for that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I only do it for Merry Christmas Eve. Yeah. I can't go beyond that. But, you know, I'm also the person who listens to Christmas music and, you know.
Yeah, we got November. A couple really excited kids in our house right now.
We really do. I think that they think tomorrow is Christmas. So we've had to tone down the expectations. We are doing some Christmas stuff with family tomorrow and Saturday and Sunday. So it's going to be, they're going to have a great few days. Or they're just going to be so tired that it's just awful.
Yeah.
One or the other. Probably a little bit of both. But some more exciting news. We have a new round of
Chick-fil-A
table
topics
roulette.
We actually realized we got a new set of them in a kids meal,
I guess we got recently. Garrett's parents, when they babysit the kids, and if they go to Chick-fil-A or something, they'll oftentimes get them kids meals, whereas we're like, when we go to Chick-fil-A, we're like, here's a medium fry, you guys split it, or like, here's a...
Something more fiscally sound.
Right, because we're not the spoiling... grandparents, you know, I get why they do that. But so very exciting for us though, because this particular kids meal came with the table topics question, and I was like, oh yeah, we know all about those, you know.
Yeah.
And then I looked at it and I was like, this is a different color. I think these are different questions. And then like come to find out, it's like
they have like five different renditions of them, and we did the what?
It's like
things we do the what?
It's something about playing. I don't know.
I know, but they categorize it. So ours, the new one is who.
Yeah, I think they have a new collection because the old ones were like things to play or something.
Yeah.
And now the collection that they have now are like who, what, when, where kind of questions. And we have the who set. So all of these questions will start out with
not like Whoville, who.
No, very easily confused at this time of year. Yes, we're not talking about the Grinch's hometown or, you know. You want to get technical, he lives on Mount Crumpet.
Crumpet, yeah.
But anyway, there's your Grinch trivia.
Mm-hmm.
So we're, of course, I was very excited about this, and I was like, I just immediately went and put them on the table that we podcast on, and was like, got to have these ready for next podcast.
Yeah. So we want to. Do we want to kick it off?
Oh yeah, you want to go
all
first?
Right. Yeah. So I'll go. Okay. Is this for me or for you?
This is for you.
Okay.
You
pick I get up your confused own every question. Time. Who haven't you seen in a while that you'd really like to visit? I haven't seen one of our previous students in the East Brainerd ministry. I haven't seen a kid named Cameron. I haven't seen Cameron in a long time.
Well, you say kid.
Well, he's not a kid anymore. No. Yeah, I realize that. But to me, they're always kids in my heart, you know, and but I haven't seen Cameron in a long time. And so he's the person that comes to mind first. And somebody that I'd love to see. He always brought a lot of joy to, you know, my life. And I remember going to a movie with him. Actually, so this latest Spider-Man movie just came out. And we went to go see that. We won't spoil anything for that.
It's
fantastic.
Fantastic. Please go see it.
But I remember going to, I can't even remember what movie it was, but I remember going to a movie with him and he dressed up as Spider-Man and watched, he was the whole movie.
I don't feel like it was a Marvel movie.
Yeah,
I feel like
but he dressed up as Spider-Man and went to the movie as Spider-Man and he kept the mask on the whole time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I got a picture on Instagram of me going to the movie with Spider-Man. Yeah.
That
was pre-Caleb, I think.
Yeah, so. That was like a legit Spider-Man costume too.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it was,
yeah,
it was nice. I mean,
yeah,
seemed real.
Yeah. And so, I miss him. I miss a lot of our, you know, previous students and stuff that we used to have over all the time. And, but he's the first person that comes to my mind as far as somebody that I would like to visit.
All right.
There you go.
Well, here's my turn. And these questions, again, roulette, so we do not prepare
these. Yeah, it's really just the first thing that comes up.
Okay, who is a good listener? Humble brag, me. No, just kidding. I would say, actually, my mom, though.
Which I knew you were going to say that.
It's almost like we've been married for a decade. I would say my mom is a good listener. She's the person I probably try to work through things mm-hmm. that I'm dealing with the most, besides you.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I would say my mom. I've, in fact, gone on walks with her we live in the same neighborhood now.
Yep.
And most people would be like, that seems like a bad idea. But it's actually been, it's great. And actually, considering how long we've lived here, I'm surprised I've gone on as few walks with her as I have.
Well, COVID stuff all kept up.
Well, COVID, and I mean, she's very, between my dad and my grandma, they have a bunch of, appointments.
Doctor's visits,
appointments and stuff that they've got to go to. So she stays pretty busy just taking care of people.
Yeah. She's definitely a good person to confide in and try to work through your problems with. So, good. Okay. So I guess what we'll do, we'll transition into Matthew chapter 2. Just a brief recap of last chapter. You know, we talked about through the genealogy and through the way that Matthew sets up his story. It really is, it's not a story that, it doesn't stand on its own. It's something that Matthew puts it forward, what he's about to tell you, as the climax of a previous story that is, you know, brought, you know, that we've read from the Hebrew Bible, or what we call the Old Testament. It doesn't stand on its own. You can certainly read it, and I think understand it, much like you could probably read or watch the seventh Harry Potter series, you know, or seventh or eighth Harry Potter movie, and understand kind of the plot line. But you're going to miss a lot of things that have led up to that. Maybe more. I think a better thing to compare it to right now would be the Marvel series. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to play on that throughout this episode a little bit to try to help understand how Matthew does some certain things. But it's like going and seeing Spider-Man. Well, I'll just, so that we don't spoil anything, we'll talk about Spider-Man Far From Home. Like going and seeing Spider-Man Far From Home. Spider-Man Far From Home came out after Endgame, which a lot of crazy things happened in Endgame, of which it was built up over time and culminated and climaxed in that story. And then Spider-Man Far From Home came out, and there were a lot of things that, if you didn't know happened in Endgame, might be confusing if you go watch Spider-Man Far From Home without having seen Endgame or understood the story as it had progressed mm-hmm. Through Spider-Man's relationship with Iron Man. How is that transitioning now? And what all is happening with that story? But you could certainly understand, like, the background. Like, you could get the plot line in the end to say, like, oh, well, there's Mysterio. Mysterio seems okay, and then he's bad, you know, and stuff. And then mm-hmm. Spider-Man's got to deal with Mysterio. So general plot line you can probably figure out. But there's a lot of intricate aspects of that that are important to the macro storyline.
Yeah.
That it's actually being worked out in that movie.
And really, they're the deeper elements of it. The deeper, like, the mental struggles, the really heart of who the character is, and their personal, I guess, journey. That sounds kind of cheesy, but just...
Yeah.
I mean, like, a very deep...
Yeah.
Inward, like, reflecting thing of, like, oh, wow, like, this is really impacting this character kind of thing.
Right, yeah. It's less about Spider-Man versus Mysterio and more about Spider-Man or Peter Parker as he works through what is life now.
Yeah.
What
do you do after such a great loss?
Yeah, exactly.
Of someone who was your personal hero.
And so, I just want to frame it like that to say, look, when we're reading Matthew... It's just like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where if you just start at the latest movie, there's going to be so many things that you're not going to understand. You might get the basic plot line, but there's going to be so many layers of it that you're going to miss, and maybe even the most important aspects of it you might miss if you weren't aware of all the previous Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, aspects. So just the same, if you just kick off Matthew, you already, like, if you've never read any of this before, you are already lost. You're like, what in the world did he just tell me through the genealogy? Like, what? Okay, clearly he has some pedigree, I guess, you know, or whatever. Like, and maybe you might glean, like, that he's the Messiah. So are you trying to tell me that he's a king, or what were you trying to tell me? But for a Jewish audience, this is very clear in saying, look, Jesus is the culmination and the climax of the story that we've lived so far. And we've been in Babylon for so long, and he's the answer to Babylon. He's the answer to our exile and to the story of David and the story of Abraham. He's connecting through the genealogy and through the way that he tells the story. He's connecting it back to them to say that God has been faithful and that Jesus is coming. He's now on the scene to end our exile. And now he starts beginning to tell a story of how is it that Jesus brought an end to the exile? What is it that he did to bring an end to the exile? How is he a new David? How is he the culmination of the Abrahamic covenant? How is he fulfilling that covenant promise that God made to our people? And so he starts beginning to tell that story, and it starts out with a son of David, Joseph, who has to he's put in a situation with Mary. Mary is betrothed to him, and she conceives by the Holy Spirit. So really odd situation. It's this new creation event. But Joseph, the son of David, he has a messenger come to him and tell him, hey, no, this is what God is doing, and you need to adopt him, essentially, and name him Jesus, which means Yahweh saves, because he will save his people from their sins. And we talked about it last time. It's not about just getting rid of sin. But the sin is the first step in transitioning into God's presence again, that we can commune with him and be in his presence, that he will dwell among us, that the whole story, this is where it is moving. It's been moving in that direction, or at least that's been the goal since Genesis 1 and 2, that God would dwell among his people. And so he's going to deal with the sins of the people so that he can dwell among us. And he says that, and he quotes Isaiah 7, which again, I'll just mention, he's reading broadly Isaiah 7 through 11, and we're going to see some more of that as we go through other chapters, not so much in this one, but he's going to keep picking up Isaiah and reading it broadly, and saying that the things that were talked about in then, yes, like Isaiah 7 is talking about something in the time of, I think, King Ahaz. It's talking about a son then, but he's typologically reading it. He's interpreting it and saying, look, this is kind of, it's a model of what Jesus is going to be, that he's going to be a son that's going to be born to us. He will be God with us, Emmanuel. And so it ended with saying that he called his name Jesus. So Joseph does as he obeys God, which is important. He obeys God, and he adopts Jesus. He names him, you know, he names this child Yahweh Saves, because he's going to save his people from their sins and basically bring people back into communion with God that was lost for so long. For 600 years, God hasn't been among us. And now here he is, Emmanuel, God with us again. So that's where we pick up the story here, moving into chapter 2. So you want to read this first section of chapter 2?
After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it was stopped over a place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route.
Okay, so we have introduction here now of a kind of a secondary story or a second story that he's going to tell along with Jesus' birth of this. I like that the NIV puts magi because it leaves it kind of opaque of like, because nobody really knows what these guys were. They seem to be priests of some kind or some dignitaries from the east that are coming and following this mysterious star that has risen, and they're following it, and it lands them in Jerusalem. Well, I mean, that seems to be a good place to go if you're going to be looking for whoever the king of Judea or the Jews or Judea would. Jews is just short for Judean, you know, like so. The king of Judea, like, or the king of the Jews, Jerusalem is a prime spot to go to ask, hey, where's this new king that's been born king of the Jews? So it's natural that they would, you know, they're kind of led there and they go to the present king. And I guess you would think that maybe, like, surely this is this guy's son or something that's been born, mm-hmm. right? So you ask him. Well, whenever he's kind of shocked by the question, now we've created a problem. You've gone and asked the new king or the existing king, the one sitting on the throne, where's the new king that's going to replace you? Mm-hmm. And especially king of this phrasing, king of the Jews. So this is only going to occur in Matthew chapter 2 and Matthew 27. So it's going to be bookended on Matthew's gospel. But King of the Jews is especially striking because that's exactly what Herod would be called by the Romans. That they would. So around 40 to 37 BC, this guy Herod, we call him Herod the Great now because there's all kinds of Herods. He had Herods that were sons of his. Herod Antipas would come up later. But Herod the Great, this is... he was a really successful ruler in Judea and the surrounding areas. He took power in 37. He's really the puppet king of Rome. He's just he's serving on Rome's behalf, essentially. That, you know, I guess they don't really want to mess with. If they can have somebody to be in power that's kind of related to other folks, they'd like to try to do that because it helps keep the peace, I suppose, as opposed to putting a Roman governor over it like Pontius Pilate. Instead, Herod is ruling over it. He's a half Jew, so like he's got Gentile origins, but he's kind of married into he married a Jewish princess, has one of the Hasmonean dynasty princesses. He married her to try to bridge the gap between other folks, but in 30 BC he murders her for supposedly trying to overthrow him, you know, like, or trying to plot against him. He would murder his children with no problem if he feared that they were trying to rise up against him. He was a very power hungry person, but he was exceptionally successful, especially building projects and things like that. He would eventually die in 4 BC. So, like, we're really kind of on the cusp of he's about to die. Shortly after this story, he's going to die. And as he's dying, he becomes more and more, you know, enraged by any possibility of somebody trying to take his power. Herod's not a good person. The things that he does are like he will do anything to maintain power. And he would rule to about 4 BC, and then we would see it change hands. But we'll talk about that a little bit of that later. But overall, he was not really liked by the people that he ruled. But he was trying. Herod was he was a really good political player in that he did whatever it took to get Rome on his side. And then he would play his cards with the Jewish people, but they just overall, if Jewish leaders saw you dealing with Rome, you were not going to be good in their books anyways. But he was also exceptionally brutal, that even at his death, he concocted a plan as he was dying that he was collecting all the Jewish leaders, and he wanted at his death that they would all be murdered. That he was putting them in prison so that somebody would weep at his death. Mm. Because he knew that nobody would be sad that he died, and so he just collected all the Jewish leaders and he wanted them killed. It didn't come to fruition, but that was what his plan was. And so, anyways, just again highlighting the brutality of the time, the brutality of what they're under. And so when you go to this guy who's been called King of the Jews by Rome, and you said, hey, we're looking for the guy named King of the Jews, this is important to the story. This is something that would ring true and well with somebody in the first century. They were like, oh yeah, King Herod was called King of the Jews. So we've got conflicting kingdoms here.
Yeah.
That whoever this is, Jesus being born named King of the Jews, it's a conflicting kingdom. And Matthew's going to talk a lot about that. What does it mean to, you know, Jesus is bringing in a new kingdom. How is it different than the previous one? How is it different than the kingdom like King Herod had as King of the Jews? And so these are, you're going to have, basically, we're starting already to butt heads in between the kingdoms of this world and the kingdom of heaven. So they go looking, and he gets nervous about it. And so he goes and he collects all the chief priests and scribes, and he says, hey, where is it that this king is supposed to be born? And they go to the scriptures and they pull up Micah chapter 5, verse 2, and Matthew quotes from it. And so just to recap or to go back, we read Micah, but you want to read that section of Micah?
Okay, so the text references specifically Micah 5, 2. We're going to read 1 through 6, mm-hmm. though.
Just to get a broader... This is what I think that all the biblical authors are trying to get you to do. They're not trying to get you to go back and just read one thing and say, look at this specific prophecy. They're trying to get you to go back and read the whole thing. So, there
you go. All right. Marshal your troops, O city of troops, for a siege is laid against us. They will strike Israel's ruler on the cheek with a rod. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. Therefore, Israel will be abandoned until the time when she who is in labor gives birth, and the rest of his brothers return to join the Israelites. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will live securely, for his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth, and he will be their peace.
Okay, so we can read that and see this is very clearly talking about a messianic figure who's going to come out of Bethlehem and be the redeemer for his people. That he's gonna bring them peace, right? Is that what it says? It says that at the end of mm-hmm. it, and that he would be a shepherd for his people. His origins are from old. Have I heard anything that kind of demonstrates origins of old in ancient days? Mm-hmm. I've already heard a genealogy that kind of that goes through that. So again, Matthew's not just trying to get you to go back and read Micah 5, 2. He's trying to get you to go back and read and even see it, you know, some individual specific prophecy. He's trying to get you to go back and read Micah and say, man, the exile is at its end, because just as it was spoken in Micah that there would be one that rises, that God's going to raise up for us, who's going to be born in Bethlehem, and he's going to deliver us into our peace, and he's going to deal with the foreign nations.
Yeah. And honestly, when we read this too, and having studied Micah, I remember when we were reading Micah talking about Bethlehem being kind of this like lowly, kind of like humble beginnings area, when you're talking and compared to, you know, like Jerusalem,
right?
You would think that that would be where the Messiah would be born, like just, or, you know, like it, yeah. You think of a place like Jerusalem, like big city,
yeah,
as where he would come to. But then I was just kind of reminded when we were going back and reflecting on this this section of Micah, how it is like this, like
nobody Bethlehem.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. You're least among everyone. And yeah, it's through you that the ruler is going to come. And this is such a biblical theme.
Yeah.
Of the, I mean, even David himself, you know, he's the youngest of his brothers, or I think Gideon is another one of those that kind of echoes that theme. Or the, like the younger one is always seems to be the one, that's taken, or that God uses. So it's like, it flips the kingdoms of the world up on its head. Mm-hmm. He uses the lowly to bring down the proud. And so I'm seeing the lowly, and I'm also seeing a proud here. It's like, so how is this going to work itself out? What all is going to happen? And so, you know, he quotes Micah, says, look, this was always bound to happen. And he also, he smushes in a little bit too, at the very end of here, of who will shepherd my people Israel, which does echo back to Micah, but also it's a direct quotation from the Septuagint of 2 Samuel chapter 5, where, so this is important, and it's hard, it's usually missed, because, so 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 2, this is a, all the people are coming and giving allegiance to David after Saul has died. I'll just read briefly. It says, for some time when Saul was king over us, this is them speaking, you were leading Israel in and out. Yahweh had said to you, you shall be a shepherd of my people Israel, and you will be the leader over Israel. And so they're kind of coming to their senses of like, you've been leading us for a long time, even though Saul was king over us. And now we're giving our allegiance to you. You're going to be Yahweh has declared that you would be the shepherd of our people. So there again, he's putting Jesus forward as a new David. But he's also making you remember the whole Saul and David story. Well, and that the competing kingdoms of Saul, you know, like Saul and David, and David was humble. He wasn't going to take it by force. He had that opportunity. He didn't do it. But then eventually God brought down Saul and raised David up. So now I have Herod and David, or Herod and Jesus being paired against each other. And it's like, well, is Jesus going to take it by force, or is he going to be like David and he's going to allow God to raise him up and allow God to be the one to bring down Israel, or bring down Herod? I guess it's a yes and, but it's still it's comparing those two stories to each other and saying this is kind of like that. It's using the story of David as a model for what Jesus is coming and doing in these competing kingdoms. So so you kind of have that play going on. And so as we go through here, we see that Herod becomes he gets nervous because, again, somebody else is competing for his throne, and he tries to convince the wise men or these magi to basically become his informants on where he is. He tries to act like, hey, I just want to go and worship you myself, but...
Trying to be sneaky.
Yeah, but they're also, they're smart, and they know what's going on here. They realize that they've messed up a little bit and talked to the wrong person, but they're... told what they said, they were warned in a dream to go a different direction. Mm-hmm. Right, they get to, or that, hey, you know, this isn't good what's happening. Mm-hmm. Here so there's a few things also echoed kind of in the background. It's kind of playing on the background of the story. The first one being that, okay, so the magi are from the east. They're priests or something like that. They're Gentiles. They're not Jewish. They're not followers of Yahweh. But they've come in from the east, and they are they go and have a meeting with the present king, and he tries to get them basically to do something that's going to hurt the chosen people of God, the chosen one of God, and they choose to resist it instead. This is very, very similar to a story in Numbers chapter 24, where a guy named Balaam, he is a Gentile priest who's called in by a king named Balak to curse Israel. And the way that the story goes is that he gets paid basically to curse Israel, but all he can do is issue blessing upon them, and ends up worshiping Yahweh essentially by his prophecy over them. And in that prophecy, he talks about how, you know, God's basically going to establish them and everything. It's a really beautiful chapter. I wish we could read all of it, but there's also a line in there where it talks about, I'm going to go to it real quick. Numbers 24. He's looking over the people of Israel who are kind of like down in this valley. And he says this, he says, the declaration of Balaam, son of Beor, and the declaration of the man whose eye is closed, the declaration of the hearer of God's words and the knower of the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of Shaddai, who is falling, and his eyes are revealed. I see him. So this is where he kind of starts now giving the prophecy. He says, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star will go out from Jacob, and a scepter will rise from Israel. It will crush the foreheads of Moab and destroy the children of Seth. And so what Balaam sees is a star rising up out of Jacob. And it's this idea of this ruler that's going to rise up and is going to bring, he's going to throw down the enemies of God, and he's going to bring, you know, good things, I guess, to Israel. So Balaam, he very much repeats a lot of this, or the Magi are kind of repeating this story of Balaam. Balaam sees this star rising up over Jacob, and the Magi are also following a star to who would be the messianic figure in Matthew's story, and saying, look, this is, I think he's putting him forward and saying, look, this is what Balaam was talking about. The one that he could see, but wasn't here. Also the one that he could behold him, but not near. Like it was coming, but it wasn't quite here yet, kind of thing. And so he's offering him forward as the star that Balaam saw. Another one of the stories here that are echoed would be the Queen of Sheba. So Queen of Sheba, I think it's 2 Kings. I think it's 2 Kings. Hold on. It's either 1 Kings 10 or 2 Kings 10. Let's see here. Treasure. There we go. 1 Kings 10. So in 1 Kings 10, the Queen of Sheba comes to see Solomon in all of his splendor. And what she's a foreign dignitary that comes to see Solomon, the son of David, and honors him with gold and spices. And so now here again, I have another story of foreign dignitaries coming to honor the son of David and offering him gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and spices, essentially. Mm-hmm. So he's putting him forward as Balaam's star. He's also putting him forward as a new Solomon. So far in the story, I've got like all these interlaced stories of saying, hey, he's the true son of Abraham, the true Israelite. He is the new David. He's the new Solomon. He's the star of Balaam. All of these different models that he's putting forward and showing Jesus is he's the one that all of these different things pointed towards, all these different stories pointed towards who Jesus would be. And so that's what he's offering up in these stories. You have any other thoughts on this section?
I think I'm good there.
Okay. All right. Sorry. I know that I talk a lot. I'm sorry, but I want to help see all the different layers to this. And all the things that
those things aren't, you know, bookmarked at the bottom.
No.
You know, you get such little snippets that you don't really see that, you know, they reference back to the direct quotes, but they don't reference back to the overall stories because they assume that you would. Well, I mean,
I think Matthew
at some point you just need to know the stories of the past,
right,
to be able to
hear the echoes.
Yeah.
It's you have to know those stories in order to be able to hear them when Matthew's telling the story. And so, it's all interlaced,
mm-hmm,
and beautifully put forward, but it is something that takes time and work, to be able to be in the scriptures, you know, to be able to hear, that type of stuff. And so, So there you go. And I'll also note that them being at a house, this seems to be a hiccup with people. Whenever they're at a house, they go to a house where he is.
Oh.
That's not, you know, because they're like, oh, well, Luke talks about a, you know, stable, whatever. Well, it's really just about where they keep the animals, and they would keep them in and among their own living space. It's not like there was like a separate location for the stable or whatever. They were in somebody's house. And largely it's the nativity scenes in churches and stuff that really throw people for a loop there and say, look, they weren't in a stable. You know, the Bible's wrong. And it's like, no, that's really just something that we've kind of supplied to it. It's just that they were not, you know, whenever it says there's no room in the inn, it's just like there was nothing in whatever their extra living space would be for guests. Instead, it was where they kept the animals in the same house,
mm-hmm.
And laid him in a manger there. So anyways, Matthew and Luke are kind of, they really just don't, it just seems like they don't know about each other's story. They hit key things that are important, you know, that we'd be consistent with, but largely it doesn't seem like they know about each other's stories. So it's kind of like you get different views on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's how things go with reporting. Here's what happened. You just hear different stories from different people, and that's just always how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that it's like contradictory. None of this is contradictory to what Luke says. It's just a different look, a different direction looking at the same scene, I suppose, of what happened. So there you go. All right, so we'll keep going. I have what I've got through 18.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now after they had gone away, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph, saying, get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and stay there until I tell you, for Herod is about to seek the life of the child to destroy him. So he got up and took the child and his mother during the night and went away to Egypt. And it was there until the death of Herod, in order that what it was said by the Lord through the prophet would be fulfilled, saying, out of Egypt I called my son. And Herod, when he saw that he had been deceived by the wise men, he became very angry. And he sent soldiers and executed all the children in Bethlehem and in the region around it, from the age of 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined precisely from the wise men. Then what was said by the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled, saying, a voice was heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she did not want to be comforted because they exist no longer.
So this section to me, I really appreciated because there were so many echoes of Exodus,
yeah.
And having studied that so deeply, like thoroughly so recently, I thought it was just a really cool thing. Because obviously right now it's kind of an ironic moment where in the Exodus story, they are fleeing from mm-hmm. Egypt. And now in this story, the Messiah is fleeing to Egypt.
Yeah.
And so there's just, it's kind of dripping with a little bit of irony there. And also just the parallels of like Herod and Pharaoh. Pharaoh also, I mean, was killing babies at one point, killing boys under, I can't remember what age.
I think it's just all the boys. Any boy that was born was thrown in the river.
And then, and how out of that one was saved.
Yep.
And that being Moses.
Right.
And so here you have Jesus being the boy that is kept safe.
Yep.
In this story. And so there's just so many parallels.
So through that, what is Matthew doing with these two stories? What is he saying about Jesus?
I mean, he's kind of showing that he is, in a way, a new Moses.
Yes.
Which you had talked about with the last section. We have kind of this like new Solomon figure, this new David figure. So we're seeing all these people who would be viewed in high regard to the Jewish readers, that this is like a new version, a culmination of all these things.
All these different models are coming into play and coming to their climax and what they all represented.
Right.
And I mean, and this was the hope of the Torah. So I mean, what would be said in the Torah is, you know, ever since Moses died, we haven't had, we haven't had a prophet like Moses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like looking back probably from Babylon and saying, you know, man, what we need a prophet like Moses. And this was the hope of the Hebrew scriptures was that there's going to be a new Moses. There's going to be a new Exodus.
Yeah.
And so now, I mean, we talk about that like through almost every minor prophet that we went through. It was like, look, they're longing for a new Exodus. They're asking God to do the Exodus thing again. And so now Matthew is putting forward this story of saying, look, that all these different things happen and this is echoing the Exodus. And he's saying, hey, there's a new Exodus about to throw down, and I'm telling you about it. Keep reading. Like, it's dripping with anticipation now.
It's like you got to go to Egypt to be redeemed from Egypt is what's kind of happening. I mean, eventually going to...
Yeah, and so he he's not, like, Jesus isn't coming in from, like, you know, he's entering into the exile of his people. Mm-hmm. You know, that he's being exiled into Egypt just like the Jewish people were. Mm-hmm. And so I was telling you, I think we talked about last time, he's being offered up as a new Israel. Well, just like Israel, he's being exiled into Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's going to be brought out of Egypt. And this is important to their story. And he's bearing the mantle of everything that means. So this is what's called typological interpretation. So Matthew's not... let me back up real quick. It says that... them going to Egypt, so because Herod was going to come and seek his life, angel comes to him or says, hey, go to Egypt because he's about to seek his life. And then he quotes Hosea chapter 11. And I'm going to read Hosea chapter 11, that this was done in order to fulfill what was written in the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. So if we go back and read Hosea 11, what's going on in Hosea 11? So Hosea 11 is a... It is a reflection on the history of Israel, and Hosea as a whole compares Israel to a wife who has gone out on God and prostituted herself. Gomer, I think, is her name in the story. She is one person that represents the whole of Israel in their prostitution to other gods. They chased after other gods and prostituted themselves out. Or his child, God's child. This is something that was mentioned in Exodus. He calls Israel his firstborn son. So we usually are just like really, we jump really quickly to saying Jesus is the son of God. But in the story, especially for Matthew's readers, there's already a son of God in this story. And the son of God in this story is Israel. And so to identify Jesus as the Son of God is to say that he's taking on the mantle of Israel. So these are two things that are happening. And so for God's child, it's that they didn't trust him and that they, you know, they abandoned him and didn't obey his voice.
Mm-hmm.
So Hosea 11 is kind of, especially 1-2, is a synopsis of the whole book of saying this is what they were. And we read about this in Exodus. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. So it's looking backwards mm-hmm. to the Exodus and saying, I loved Israel. And I called them out of Egypt. I brought them out of Egypt. And when I called them, they went from my face and they sacrificed to the Baals and and sacrificed to idols. And I myself taught Ephraim to walk like a father teaching a child to walk. I took them in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I drew them with human ties and with bands of love. I was like one who lifted up a yoke on their jaws, and I bent down to them and let them eat. And feeding his children. Like, this is the Exodus story. So this is not a prediction of the future. Okay, so like that's something that we got to square with, of saying this isn't like some specific prediction that's saying, oh, look, here's Jesus. That's not what it was for. It was looking backwards. So, like I said, this is what's called typological interpretation. So he's identifying Jesus by laying the mantle of Israel on him and saying he's becoming a new Israel. So I'll go back to Marvel Cinematic Universe real quick. So Spider-Man Far From Home has been out for a long time. So, spoilers if you haven't seen it, but good
grief.
That's on you. That's on you at this point. So, Spider-Man Far From Home, what happens in that story? Well, like I mentioned earlier, Endgame was the previous movie right before that. Endgame, Tony Stark dies. Tony Stark is the central character to the story for the most part. I mean, he's the one that, like, he kind of kicks it all off with, you know, he's Iron Man, you know? And so he's one of the leaders of the Avengers. He was a mentor to Spider-Man in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Well, Tony Stark has died. And so the Far From Home is picking up and saying, well, who's going to be the new Iron Man? And what does that look like? And Peter Parker is working through what is life like without Iron Man? And how do I do this whole superhero thing without Iron Man around? Well, there's a scene in part of it where, you know, he's really struggling with it. And he's like kind of breaking down with Happy Hogan. And you know, he's like, and Happy's trying to guide him through it. And he's just like, hey, nobody can be, you know, nobody's Tony Stark or whatever. And so again, the question for the mega story is, well, who's going to replace Iron Man? Who's the new Iron Man?
Mm-hmm.
And so like Peter Parker gets this resolve, you know, he's like, I want to destroy Mysterio or whatever. And so he gets this resolve and he's like, all right, I'm going to go up. And Happy says like, all right, I'll get the music and you can get the suit or whatever. And so he's going to make himself a new suit. Well, he starts making himself a new suit on this little fabricator or whatever. And Happy Hogan turns on AC/DC. I think it's Back in Black that he turns on. He turns on Back in Black. And at the same time, Spider-Man puts his hand down into the fabricator like for like a glove or whatever. Well, the scene like echoes what Iron Man did in Iron Man 1 whenever he was making his suit and he was fabricating it. You've got AC/DC playing in the background and you've got him making his suit and everything. So... what they did was they took the previous scene and they laid it on top of Spider-Man and what he was doing. And they don't say it, but they're doing it in the movie and saying that, look, Spider-Man is the new Iron Man. But the question is in what way is he going to be the new Iron Man? You know, is he going to, because clearly Peter Parker's not going to be, you know, narcissistic. He's not a narcissistic guy the way that Tony Stark was, but is he going to be, you know, in what way is he going to be that type of leader that they need?
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyways, that's typological in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That's typological interpretation. Was the glove scene for Iron Man, was that meant to be a pointer towards saying, Spider-Man's going to become the new Iron Man? That just wasn't in the picture at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But then whenever you see it happen and you're like, oh, this was like Spider-Man is the new one. And so that's what Matthew's doing. I know that took the long way around here, but that helps me put in perspective, what is Matthew doing? He is looking backwards at Israel's story and then looking at what happened with Jesus. And he's saying, look, he bore the mantle. Like he is the new Israel, because look at all this stuff that happened with him. And, you know, and just like we went into Egypt and we came out of it, so he went into Egypt. He's gone into our exile and he's going to come out of our exile. He's going to be the one that brings it forward. He's not just kind of like on a cloud and outside of our exile. He's actually entering into our exile.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's typologically reading Matthew. This is a little quote from R.T. France. He says, this is a statement of the past, not a prediction of the future, and talking about Hosea. It is therefore sometimes argued that Matthew's use of the text here is quite illegitimate. Transferring to the future and to a different and individual son what God said about his son Israel in the past. But of course, this is the essence of typology, which depends not on predictions but on transferable models of the Old Testament story. The Exodus, leading as it did to the formation of a new people of God, was a potent symbol, even within the Old Testament, of the even greater work of deliverance which God was yet to accomplish. And Matthew has taken up that prophetic typology and applied it to the new Exodus, which has come about through Jesus. The events which constituted Israel as a special people of God under Moses are now finding their counterpart in the even more fundamental and eschatological role of the new Moses. Not only is Jesus, in Matthew's view, the founder of a new community of people of God, but he also himself embodies it as not only Israel's leader, but himself the true Israel. So that's what's happening here. It's not, he's not taking it out of context and whatever. He's typologically reading Jesus in the story of Israel. And I think that that's important for us to note. So you have any other follow-up thoughts on that?
Well, I know that was not specifically that, just on this section before you get into, because I'm sure you're going to talk about 18.
Yeah.
I just kind of wanted to note that between this section where you have, you know, Jesus and Joseph and Mary going to, you know, fleeing to Egypt. And then the last section you have, like, and how it says King Herod was disturbed and all Jerusalem with him. And so you think of Jerusalem as being his, where his people are.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of noting that he has a very similar vibe to me as Moses.
Yeah.
In that he is jumping around from place to place and constantly being kind of like a foreigner in his own land. Because, you know, I think we said multiple times over the Exodus podcast, we were like, Moses, born in Egypt, but not an Egyptian's. Then he goes and he marries a, what, Midianite woman. And then he's going back to Egypt. He's like, you know, he's going back to Egypt to try to, you know, by direction of God, to be this leader for God, to deliver the people who are like not really sure if they want his help initially. You know,
yeah,
what I mean? Like,
yeah, I mean,
there's
this
struggle because it's like he was raised by Egyptians. It's kind of reminding me of that Buddy the Elf thing. Raised by.
I was. I'm an elf.
I'm a human raised by elves. So that's kind of a side note there. Merry Christmas for you. But so you kind of have, you know, that's another parallel in and of itself to me of like, you've got all these different places that you're thinking about of like the fact that they had, that Mary had to leave in the first place to give birth somewhere else. Then they're having to go somewhere else. Then, you know, we'll see as the rest of this story goes, there's going to be another another place mentioned. And so you have all of that. And I'm just thinking, I'm like, well, this isn't just like, yeah, that's Moses' story too, of like not really having a home.
Yeah.
But also you think about Ruth and how like throughout the whole, it's the book is Ruth. And yet they remind us over and over again that she is a Moabite.
Yeah.
And that is just to really emphasize her foreigner status.
Yeah.
And that those people were not well liked.
Yeah.
And so I just think, you know, then of course Ruth we see in the genealogy. So I'm bringing this all together as like God choosing foreigners.
Yeah.
God choosing people who by all society's viewpoints are outsiders.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he like you said, he's a foreigner among his own people. That's important to the story.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that R.T. France points out in his like kind of introduction to Matthew is that it's important that we recognize that, so there's a geographical aspect to the story where, you know, it begins in Bethlehem, right? Kind of deal. Bethlehem in Jerusalem, which is in Judea, which is where the king should come from. But he's exiled from the land. And he's not going to make it back to Jerusalem until he's about to be executed. And so it's a story of someone exiled and rejected by his own people. And we'll talk more about that here in the last section. But before we get to that, so again, the echoes of Exodus in that he's, you know, Herod becomes crazy and, you know, murders baby boys. This is probably, based off of the numbers in Bethlehem at the time, this is more likely around a number 6. Maximum 20 children, more likely number like 6 to 8 children that were killed.
That's not good, but
it tends to be conflated, I think, or inflated. I suppose. to mac, you know, massive numbers, and it was more likely somewhere around 6 to 8. So this is, a lot of people say, look, this never happened because this is the only place that it's recorded. But in all of the horrible things that Herod did, this would register very low on that list, unfortunately, for that. I mean, because it doesn't have any political implications. Mm-hmm. The murder of his own children would have political implications that Josephus would record later, but this one doesn't make it in anything else. But that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. It's just, so to say that it didn't happen because it's not recorded somewhere else is just by an argument of science or silence, which is not a very good, doesn't stand on, you know, very good legs. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so he becomes crazy and, you know, executes the children, which echoes Pharaoh. And through this is a quote. He has another quotation. He says, "A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children, and she did not want to be comforted because they exist no longer." So this is a quotation from Jeremiah 31. So I'm going to go read Jeremiah 31 here. Background. Ramah is a place where, as they were going out into exile, this was a place that they were taken through. So it was a stop on the way to their exile. And so Rachel, who died near Bethlehem, is personified in Jeremiah 31 as weeping over her children as they go off into exile because they're no more. Again, it's about the exile that this is quoted for. But what I think what's more important to this is that Jeremiah 31 is almost exclusively a positive chapter in your Bible.
Yeah.
This is the only negative statement in the whole chapter of Jeremiah 31. Did you have this or did you? I'm going to read. I'm going to read around it a little bit. So Jeremiah 31, I'll just note this. This is Yahweh saying, look, I'm coming for you to bring you back from exile. Jeremiah 31 is the new covenant chapter. This is the one that we talk about if we do Lord's Supper and stuff. We talk about Jeremiah 31 because it's the establishment of the new covenant or the promise that he's going to establish a new covenant. But here's some language from it. He says, "The people of the survivors of the sword found grace in the desert. Israel going to find their rest. From afar, Yahweh appeared to me, saying, I have loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore, I have drawn you with loyal love. I will again build you, and you will be built, O virgin Israel. You will again adorn yourself with the tambourines, and you will go forth dancing and ring a ring of merrymakers. You will again plant vineyards on the mountains of Samaria. The planters will plant, and you will enjoy it. For there will be a day when the watchmen will call from the hills of Ephraim, stand up and let us go up to Zion, to Yahweh our God." More awesome stuff that goes on. It says, "With weeping they will come, and with pleas for mercy I will bring them." So I'm going to bring them back. "And I will let them walk by streams of water in a straight path. They will not stumble in it, for I have become to Israel a father, and Ephraim, he is my firstborn." A lot of echoes here that we keep hearing. So as we go through here, I'll start in verse 13. It says, "Then the young woman will rejoice in the dancing in a ring, and the young men and the old men together, and I will turn their mourning into jubilation, and I will comfort them. I will gladden them from their sorrow, and I will saturate the appetite of the priests with fatness, and my people will be satisfied with my goodness, declares Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation, the weeping of bitterness. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted because of her children, for they are no more. Thus says Yahweh, restrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for there is a reward for your work, declares Yahweh, and they will return from the land of the enemy. And there is hope for your future, declares Yahweh, and your children will return to their territory."